Welcome to the Bible class of Jews for Jesus with Bob Mendelson.
Let's turn in our Bibles to the book of Amos, chapter 5, as we study it for the third time of 5, to remind us just for a moment of what we did last week, not to repeat it, but it was the four judgment speeches against Israel. The first one because he expected more from us and there was economic and religious problem and oppression. The second because we abused privileges of being in covenant with God. The third judgment in rejecting divine warnings, which he'll repeat again tonight. And number four, perverting worship and justice. And again, he'll repeat that tonight. We're going to look from chapter 5, verse 18, at the two warning speeches against Israel. My guess is that these speeches were given at various times, and these few verses of each are the highlights of the text. He would have stood up in the midst of national Israel. He might have been up at a capital city, or think Tamworth, think Armidale, think Gosford. He's in the capital city, not massively capital, but the capital of the region, Wollongong. And he's there and he's ready to speak. And there are 25 elders and 15 shepherds and some pretty important people and some pretty regular people. And maybe there might be 100 people there. The word then is given to the leaders. The leaders are responsible to transmit it to their people. If he's there on Shabbat or on a festival, which makes sense in light of what he's going to say tonight, then he might be in the midst of a regular community gathered. But I see these as the highlights of speeches rather than the exhaustive or comprehensive speech themselves. So chapter 5, verse 18 is where we pick up tonight. Remember, last week was all about seeking God and living. This would be a speech, a warning speech. It sounds like a curse, but it is not. And I'll show you why not in just a moment. Alas, the Hebrew, hoy, almost where we get oy. Hoy, hey, yo, you who are longing for the day of the Lord, he says. Now, when we read this phrase, day of the Lord, Yom Yahweh, what does that mean? Well, he's going to explain it. And the problem is that they thought the day of the Lord is the day of their being crowned king. Yippee, the day of God is when we're going to become triumphant over Edom and Ammon and Moab and Damascus and all these people. Yo, we're going to be shown to be somebody. And he says, yo, you're looking for the day of God and you are in trouble. Will the day of the Lord, will the purpose be to you? What will it be? It will be darkness and not light. Uchoshech below or. It is dark and it is not light. You can't be more dramatic. It is more like Genesis 1 than you ever wanted it to be. So as Genesis 1 introduces the days of the Lord with light and dark as the theme, in the same way the ending will be light and dark, but it won't be light. Why won't it be light for the Israel of that day? Because they've been living in sin, living in pride, living in indulgence, self-indulgence, idolatry, that's right, and mistreatment of other peoples. So you think, woohoo, we're going to get ours, and he says, you're right, you're going to get yours. Verse 19, as when a man flees from a lion and thinks he's escaped, and a bear then meets him. So you think you're getting away with something, you're going to be hit with something worse. You run away from one trouble, and you're going to fall in a bigger one. Or you go home and lean your hand against the wall. This is, again, a picture of security, self-security. I'm going to lean my hand against the wall, meaning I'm going to keep the bad guys out, and then up from the bottom comes a snake to bite you from inside your house. So you think you're safe, you think you're secure, and everywhere you are going to cop judgment. Will not the day of the Lord be darkness? Halo choshech yom Yahweh velo or. I mean, you can't be simpler, you can't be clearer. It is dark, not light. Even gloom with not a bit of brightness in it. For those who live wrongly.
The word brightness is noga.
Nun, gimel, he. It also is the word for Venus, the planet. So that's a picture of problem. It's a picture of no hope. And it's not a picture you want to have sung over you. Why? Because we misunderstood what the day of the Lord was. Verse 21, God now speaks. Now, we've talked about the judgment speeches being introduced with, thus says the Lord. But this doesn't start with, thus says God. It starts with, I hate. This is God speaking. It's not even introduced. So this is why I call it a woe speech rather than a judgment speech. The judgment speech has a proper pattern. This doesn't fit it precisely. So we call it a woe speech. I hate, I reject your festivals. Whose festivals are these? Nor do I delight in your solemn assemblies. Whose festivals? I'm so sick of your doing your festivals your way. You're not doing them my way. They're unrecognizable to anybody out there as my festival. They're not my festivals. They're not my solemn assemblies. They are yours because we have misconstrued it, dishonored it. For God to hate something and to reject something is huge. Chageichem, your chugs. And solemn assemblies is the atzrotechem. So let's ponder this. When we think about doing the religion of the Jewish people, we more often are concerned, and I hear it a lot, with what are the rules. You hear that when people say, hey, it's Lag BaOmer.
Yes.
What are we supposed to do on that? It's Rosh Hashanah. What's the rule? When do we eat? Do we not eat? What time does the stars come? You know, we're more concerned about the regulation than the purpose. The regulations rather than, get this, the regulator. And I'm worried that I'm going to hear something like this. I hate, I reject your chag, your festivals, the way you celebrate. I don't want to just say, well, I'm doing Rosh Hashanah the rabbi's way, or I'm doing Rosh Hashanah the way the Jews have done it for a century or a millennium. Because honestly, the Jews had been doing religion pretty well and canonized it and dealt with it in an appropriate way. We've been following the religion of whoever the leaders were at the time. But God hated it. So merely modeling what is not exactly the way to please God. What does please Him? Well, He's going to tell us. Even though you offer up, verse 22, to me burnt offerings and your, not His, not the ones I required, grain offerings. Burnt offerings are the olah, the whole burnt offering, the thing that ascends, and the grain offering, the mincha, the afternoon offering, the cereal offering, I will not accept them. But wait a minute, God, you commanded these. Leviticus is full on with all these offerings that we're required to bring. So you'd almost want to say, God, are you schizophrenic? You want it, you don't want it. You know, if you're a kid and your father says, hey, what, be here at 6, and then you show up at 6, and he says, I hate that you showed up at 6. Wouldn't you be confused? So no wonder some people knock this back and say, well, Amos was just a bit battle-weary in dealing with the people of Israel who weren't listening to him. So he says, I'll tell you what, I hate your festivals. As if he's an aggro prophet, aggravated at the people. No, I will not accept them. I will not even look at the peace offerings of your fatlings. Verse 22. I won't even look at it. Think about it this way. Your offerings make me sick. I can't even stand to look at them. You ever thought about that? I just can't stand what that is. If you were a generous person, a loving person, and you were part of the community of Israel up there in the north, and you heard this, what would be your response? This is a good, righteous, holy person up there in Israel. I'm not going to say there aren't any. What I'm saying is a holy person is going to say he's right. Because he's going to be as upset at the sin of the rest of his community as he is. And he's going to be saying, finally, somebody who's preaching rather than the shepherds who've been teaching us wrong. So he's going to actually line up with Amos and cheer Amos on. And he'll be the two or three who are on his team of his constituency, we'll say.
How did a prophet in ancient Israel, like Amos and all that, disseminate the things that God told them? How did he spread to the people? And how did they get the message? Or perhaps they never listened to him at first, and later on, after his time, they wrote it down.
When it was actually scribed is hard to know. We looked at one of them who said, take the vision, write it down, make it plain. And so we get the impression that he probably wrote it on a scroll and transferred that, and then somebody else scribed it. And passed it on. About the time of Ezra is about the time of the scribes, and that's when scribing became a ministry that was substantial in the Jewish community, and that's later than Amos. So probably it was all verbal at this time. It might have been scribed, but it is unlikely, I think. So he would have gone and preached this message over and over and over again. They didn't have DVDs to hand out. It was just he and the people. And he'd always start with the leaders and then possibly in the regular community.
I feel that the people weren't scared that they were doing wrong.
You're right. And they were full of themselves, which is what he's chiding. And their security is going to go to insecurity and exile. That's where we're going with this. Will not the day of the Lord be darkness? Okay, gloom, brightness. I hate, even though you offer up all these things. Take away from me the noise, verse 23, of your songs. Again, not his songs, not his psalter, but the songs that the people made up. And again, it's not the words, but the inconsistent behavior of the singing of praises while doing the wrong with their hands. And we see that in the prophet and the apostle James in his writing. What this mouth is going to talk this and that at the same time, it's going to speak, if you will, with forked tongue, that you're going to, from the same fountain, bring forth life and death, something bitter and something fresh. So you've got to match. Your whole life is one persona. Schizophrenia is not a good behavior trait. It's not a proper thing for a person. I'm not talking about the mental disease. I'm talking about living one thing and preaching another. James also said, so speak and so act. The modern phrase we would use is practice what you preach. And that means live it and say it. Say it and live it. You can't just live it. You've got to say it as well. Your friends have to know you're believers. Your enemies have to know that you're believers. Everybody around you has to know you're a believer, both by what you say and by how you live. A story's told of a policeman who arrested, drove up, and he was a traffic cop, and he chased and pulled over a guy, and he wanted to see the registration and all that when he pulls him over. He says, here it is, officer, I'm so sorry, I was just in a hurry to get to my Christian meeting. And he said, well, I saw the bumper sticker on the back that said, honk if you love Jesus, but I thought the way you were driving, this had to be a stolen car. Make your testimony match who you are, and make what you are match your testimony. It's both. Speak it and live it. Live it and speak it. I mean, there are some believers who don't want to ever say anything, because I don't want to offend anybody. I don't want to tell the people in my neighborhood I might offend them. I don't want to tell that Jewish guy next door that Jesus is the Messiah. I might lose him as my friend. All these things. We have all kinds of reasons. I've heard this before. I don't want to put a bumper sticker on my car, because then I have to drive differently. I have to live differently. I don't want to be known as a believer, because then I have to act differently. Well, there you go. Then what does that say really about you? So we want to make sure that verse 24 now is our verse, so that the day of the Lord for us becomes a day of light and not a day of darkness. For it says here, let justice roll down kamayim, just like waters, and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. Eyal kamayim mishpat, justice. Not tzedakah, not tzedek, but mishpat, real judgment, truth. Good tzedakah kanachal etan, and righteousness like this stream that keeps on, keeps on, keeps on flowing. There's something that's not just a little bit of moisture, you got a little wet, but it's ever flowing. And it is not the regulations of God, but the mercies of God that adjust you to it. I was thinking a lot about water over the weekend. I went to the 40th anniversary of a church in Lawrence, Kansas over the weekend. I left Friday. Last week we met on Thursday, and I left Friday afternoon and got in Friday night, in a day, as you cross the date line. So I made it in Friday night. Saturday morning I preached at a message in a congregation in Kansas City, and then Saturday afternoon and night, Sunday morning, Sunday afternoon and night was the reunion anniversary, homecoming, if you will, of this church. Why did I go? Because I started the church 40 years ago, and it was such a joy to be with the hundreds of people who were there now, who had been there 40 years ago. We pondered a lot of things, and we talked about streams. And it was one of those things, there were little pockets of gatherings here and there back in 1972, 73, 74. This guy had a meeting at his house. This guy had a meeting at his house. There were little things. Some people would go to everything, and some people went to that guy's or those or this. and I'm of Paul, I'm of Apollos, I'm of Chloe. And the ones that were together on the weekend last were those who let the river flow together into us. So we all swam together, if you will. There were those whom we knew 40 years ago who would still be apart from us because they never let each other splash against. There was something physical about co-relating and about being together. One of the reasons I like sitting in whatever geometric form we're in tonight, in somewhat of a circle or a rectangle or whatever, so that there's no head of the table, is there? We're all just around wherever you sit. That's where you sit, and we all sit. And we're allowing ourselves to be fellows in the same ship. We're allowing ourselves to splash against one another. And the ones who are not here, who won't come, or who have their meeting in their little place and say, we're the Messianic community of Sydney, or their leader won't come to the leaders' meeting and won't co-relate, they're going to be left on the side, and they're not going to be splashing together 4 decades from now, even 1 decade, maybe even 1 year from now. There are those who just refuse to co-relate and separate. What does the proverb say? He that separates himself seeks his own glory. It's just too obvious. I've seen that not only in Messianic circles, but in so many other circles. And the ones who withdraw take their salt away from the rest of the river. But the salty river brings trout. All kinds of good things can splash in it and grow and thrive. And we relate together and grow from each other. That's the blessing of community. Now, that's just one of the impressions I've had about streams, that they are ever flowing. Because it's now not something I say, well, I did that 40 years ago or 20 years ago or 5 years ago. I don't need to do it now. No, we still need to be doing it, and we still need to be co-relating. One of the great things about One New Man, I like it when I see you guys go off together and get a coffee and get a pizza and hang out and share. I think food helps in community, and I want to encourage that with regularity, even after Bible class. It's good for us to do that, and I want to encourage that the more and more. But that's not the point. That's just a point that I draw and I infer. What it's really saying is the reason that the day of Yahweh will be dark is that we're not letting justice roll down like waters, and we're not letting righteousness be that ever-flowing stream. So we're living in injustice and unrighteousness, and we've described that in the previous chapters as the Jewish people up north were living godlessly, selling each other for slaves, sleeping with anyone and everyone, and it was horrible. So why do religion? Why bring sacrifices? Why do religious activity? And God is unhappy with that. So the warning of what this is pretty clear. And the reason I think it's not a curse is that God says, let justice roll down like waters. If it's a curse, there's hopelessness. But this says, the day of Yahweh is dark. But let justice roll down sounds like, and then it'll be different. So it sounds not like a curse, but a warning. And that is always hopeful.
That the curse by the choice of death could reverse the decree.
That's correct. We saw that in Jonah. Jonah who walks into Nineveh and says, in a month and a half, you people are dead, right? You had 40 days and God will judge you. Yippee, he's thinking. And then the king of Nineveh and everybody repent, and Jonah's not happy, but God relents from the judgment that was surely there. So that declaration that Jonah gave is the same as Amos is giving here. You are in trouble. And there's a hint of, but there's hope. I like that. Chapter 5, verse 25. Did you present me with sacrifice and grain offerings in the wilderness for 40 years in the house of Israel? That's a question. Is it rhetorical? Did they do it? Did they present grain offerings in the wilderness?
They did, didn't they? They had a tent of the meeting.
So they must have done it. So it's rhetorical. In other words, you did this for 40 years. It's a hearkening to the wilderness wandering. What does that tell you? Who was involved in wilderness wandering worship? 600,000 men, according to Numbers chapter 1, left Egypt. All of them, save two, over 20 years old, all of them, save two, perished in the wilderness. So what is that saying? I'm reminding you that you, your great-great-granddaddy, died in the wilderness because he didn't get it right. You get it right or else you're going to die in your wilderness. This is an historical reference calling to mind that God was able to do it then. He's able to do it now. So it's another recall of history by which we learn. Remember George Santayana's who said, he that's ignorant of the past is condemned to repeat it. So then he says this thing in verse 26, you also carried along Sikut, your king, and Kiyun, same vowel form, the star of your gods which you made for yourselves. I didn't know anything about this, so I looked it up. It needs attention. How are we to understand the Hebrew Sikut? We can repoint the first word as Sukkot and translate it shrine or tabernacle. That's, by the way, what the Septuagint. The phrase would then read the shrine of your king or the shrine of the Milcom, that is Molech, the name of an Ammonite deity. The other difficult word is Kiyun, translated variously pedestal, or is the name of a deity. The mention of an astral deity, the star of your god, that is star god, gives us the clue that proper names are meant to by the Hebrew words. And Mesopotamian texts list the terms Sakut and Kaiwanu, which the Septuagint and Acts chapter 7 misspell as Raphon, as names of the planet Saturn. The Hebrew vowels in both words, the E before the U, are the result of a familiar device in which names of idols or pagan deities are deliberately misspelled to brand as shameful or abominable. Here the two vowels often are used to describe idols of a detestable thing. They were substituted both to label and mock the foreign deities. So it's pretty deep, and I appreciate the work that some of these guys go through in commentary. That's from the Tyndale commentary. So therefore, God says, I will make you go into exile beyond Damascus, says the Lord, whose name is the God of hosts. That's his name. What's the God of hosts mean?
Adonai Tzevaot.
Adonai Tzevaot. I am the God of armies. So here, you thought you were secure. You thought you were protected. You're up on your holy hill, and I'm going to knock you down, gather you, and kick you out from the very secure place. This is devastating. You look at Jewish people today, even though we're scattered, the number one thing that is the hope of the Jewish people today is Israel. Yom HaTzmaut was just last week, this week. So we celebrate the 64th birthday. It's the 64th birthday of the land of Israel, and we think that's the greatest thing. Christians are so captivated with this. I had people call today, two or three different people call about various pro-Israel things. One, a speech that somebody was giving. One, a writing that he'd read on the internet. One, a lady found a DVD that she thought was the Cat's Meow about some segment of some geography that Jews were supposed to reclaim. And it's all about Israel, and Israel's the focus. And you look at the Jewish news every week, any week, and you will see oodles on Israel. Israel is the focus. You won't find anything mentioning, oh, I don't know, God. But Israel is the focus. Now, we could look at the God of the stars or Saturn or Raphon, and we'd be just as guilty as looking at a bunch of dirt and rocks called the land of Israel today. It is a danger that we become Israelolaters instead of God worshippers. It is a danger. Just
because. Why? Because the Jews in general have all become atheistic and secular. So all they can hope for in their insecurity is Israel. They don't place their hopes in God as they should.
So the problem is that we're not going to model what the Jews do because that's what Jews do. We're going to model what God said because that's what Jews should do. Chapter 6. Woe to those who are at ease in Zion. Woe. Again, there's that word, hoi. It says woe here, but in chapter 5 it said alas. 5:18. But it's the same word, hoi. Ve is mir. Hoi ve. Hoi woe. Ve is mir. Woe is me. That's the Yiddish. It's funny how the Hebrew and the Yiddish merge into hoi ve. Woe to those who are at ease in Zion, to those who feel secure in the mountain of Samaria, the distinguished men of the foremost of nations to whom the house of Israel comes. And don't poor people go to the rich. Don't poor people always come to the rich, whether it's a bank loan or food or some kind of job. The poor are always going to the rich. The distinguished men are receiving the house of Israel coming. And here we have a picture not of injustice, but of wealth misapplied or not applied. Go over to Cullnan, look, and go over from there to Hamath the Great. Go down to Gath of the Philistines. Are they better than these kingdoms? Or is their territory greater than yours? You put off the day of calamity, and would you bring near the seat of violence? rhetorical. Obviously, no. Are they better than these kingdoms? No. Their territory greater than yours? No. But he's painting Israel into the corner of her riches. And so what he says in verse 4, those who recline on beds of ivory and sprawl on their couches and eat lambs from the flock and calves from the midst of the stall, who improvise to the sound of the harp and like David have composed songs for themselves, who drink wine from sacrificial bowls while they anoint themselves with the finest of oils, yet they have not grieved over the ruin of Joseph. So we've painted ourselves in the lap of luxury. I love that. I mean, I hate that. Reclining on beds of ivory. Where do you get ivory? Africa, elephant tusks. This is an expensive, luxurious item. Modern day, we'd say leather, even suede, maybe. We'd say something. What's the most lavish thing you can think of? Thai silk? I was gobsmacked. I went into a department store yesterday in America, and I was picking up something for Patty to come back, and there were men's ties there. And I was used to ties being, in this particular department store, maybe $30, which I thought was obscene, because you can get 3 for $10 on the streets of New York City. But this was $55 for a silk tie. There was another one for another rack of them for $89. Who buys ties like this? What's funny is a tie used to be a cover for a shirt to protect your shirt. Now they have covers for ties to protect the tie, to protect the shirt, which probably used to protect just another shirt. We don't want to get anything ruined, so we cover the cover. All that to say simply that riches won't protect us, that they in fact expose us. Again, it's not having riches, but it's the misuse of riches. You can be poor and cheap. You can be poor and criminal. You can be poor and selfish. Poverty doesn't make you holy. Riches doesn't make you guilty. But the misuse or non-use of wealth is exactly what God has always been concerned about. So let justice roll down like waters and righteousness burst forth or flow like ever-flowing streams. That's in terms of jurisprudence, as in the first woe speech, and now here in terms of wealth. So he's going to use all these pictures of things that they have, where they sleep, what they eat, what they sing, their musical entertainment, improvising to the sound of harp, compose songs for themselves, drinking wine from sacrificial bowls. So these were bowls that were used for the altar when you'd bring an offering of food or drink. A libation, it's called. So you'd pour out wine around the altar. You'd use a bowl, a pitcher, we would say.
All right.
And so they're drinking from these things in a personal way that belong to God. They're using what was sacred as secular. They're using something profound as something profane. And they're using it for themselves instead of to honor God. That's really the issue. We read in Haggai, was it, that he was upset about their living on God's money, really. You live in good houses while the temple of God is broken down, the house of God is in ruins. How dare you? You know, we should always build God's house before we build our house. And we should let God have his sacrifices and not take it for ourselves. While they anoint themselves with the finest of oils, yet they have not grieved over the ruin of Joseph. What's the ruin of Joseph? They're not grieving over what's happening in the Jewish community all around them. It's a good way to see it. Therefore, they will now go into exile at the head of the exiles. At the head of the exiles? In other words, you think you're going to be at the back of the pack. You think you're not going to even be in the pack. You're going to be at the front of it. And remember, the most honored, formerly honored, are the people in the front of an exile parade. So if Julia Gillard loses in the next election, and it's an old school parade in this term, then whoever the liberal minister is who defeats her would walk with his entourage up front, gallant, valiant, and then the first one in the procession behind of conquered foes would be Julia. So here Israel is told, you think you're not even going to go into exile. You think you're above that fray. You're going to be at the head of the exile parade. You're going to be the head loser, the greatest loser. And the sprawlers banqueting will pass away. God has sworn by himself. The Lord God of hosts has declared, I loathe the arrogance of Jacob and detest his citadels. Armon is the Hebrew word for citadel and sounds like army. And I don't know if the word army, armon, I don't know if it came from the Hebrew armon. God says, I'm going to deliver up the city and all it contains, and no one will escape. I hate the arrogance of Jacob. So earlier he hated our religion. Today he hates our pride. This is the second of the two great woe speeches. Woe speech number one is religious externals over against our own bad testimony. And the second woe is living richly and proudly over against your fellow brother, not treating your fellow as a fellow. God hates it, loathes it. Woe to us if we start acting like that at all. Detest, what's a citadel?
A fortified city?
It is the structure, it might be palatial behind it, but it's really the military tower where the guards guard and the people shoot or prevent anybody else coming in. So it's really the point place of the arrogance of a military that thinks itself inconquerable, unconquerable. And God hates it and detests it, his citadel. So now he's gone into third person. Chapter 5 was all about second person. I hate your feasts. Now, I won't even talk to you. I'm not even going to deal with you. The Lord hates you, hates them, his problem. Therefore, I'll develop the city and all it contains, and it will be, if 10 men are left in one house, they will die. Then one's uncle or his undertaker will lift him up to carry his bones from the house, and he'll say to the one who's in the innermost part of the house, is anyone else with you? And that one will say, no one. Then he'll answer, keep quiet. The name of the Lord is not to be mentioned. Behold, the Lord is going to command that the great house be smashed to pieces, small house to fragments. Whether it's the governmental palace or the governmental military fortress or the private sector homes, no one is going to escape. Everyone in their own way is going to cop it because Israel is being judged. Small and great. This is universal, comprehensive judgment. What would a righteous man do who hears this? He would say, you're right, Amos. I am wrong. We are wrong. We deserve punishment. God help us. And I think that's the right thing for us as Jews in these days, to hear the judgment on Vaucluse and Watson's Bay and on Rose Bay and Bellevue Hill. And we should not say, those Jews, but we Jews. Not they are going to cop it, but we're going to cop it. Lord, have mercy on it. God be merciful to me, a sinner. God be merciful to us. In verses 1 to 7, we see that the rich are idle against all the needs of the people around them. We see that in verse number 8, God says, I will judge. In fact, he swears by himself. He swears by himself. That's such a funny thing to do. But he says that throughout the scriptures. We see that again and again. It just means that there's nobody out there on whom he can swear besides himself. Because Israel and Judah, doggone it, these are the people I need on my ball team, and they're no good. Isaiah said something like that when he was caught out with his own sin, and he said, woe is me, I'm undone, I'm a sinner, basically. And I dwell among a people of unclean lips, meaning they can't help me either. So verse 8, we see God judging all by himself. Verses 9 and 10, we see the complete desolation that's going to happen across the board, comprehensive. And then verse 11 to 14, the invasion and the exile as a result. Horses running on rocks, one plow them with oxen, yet you've turned justice into poison, fruit of righteousness into wormwood. You know the Russian word for wormwood? Chernobyl. You who rejoice in Lo Debar and say, have we not by our own strength taken Karnaim for ourselves? Behold, I'm going to raise up a nation against you, O house of Israel, and they'll afflict you from the entrance of Hamath to the brook of the Arabah. Comprehensive. We're going to be exiled. We're going to lose. So no one is going to escape. What's the hint? What's the way of escape? Let justice roll down like waters. Live it. We saw last week the way to live it is to seek God. Seek God and you will live. This week he says, so get it right. Get it right and you will avert justice. In other words, don't get it right and you will cop it. Pretty simple, pretty binary. But that's the message of Amos. He is relentless. And next week we're going to see 5 visions and more judgment against Israel.
You've been listening to the Bible class of Jews for Jesus in Australia. For more information, contact Jews for Jesus, Post Office Box 925, Sydney, Australia 2001. God bless you.